I picked up my bass and without thinking played the first note my finger landed on. It sounded horrible, so I quickly slid my finger down one fret. Michael was correct. I was now on a right note and it sounded good. I wanted to test his theory, so I played the same wrong note again, but this time I slid my finger up one fret. Like before, I was on a right note. It made me smile. I also noticed something else. I wasn't sure as yet that it was really happening, so I repeated the process a few more times. I then found a different wrong note to start on and repeated the whole process. What I noticed shocked me. I started to tell him what I discovered. Seeing the expression on my face, he spoke first. "Go ahead, tell me." It was difficult to explain, but I gave it a try. I noticed that when I went from the wrong notes to the right notes over and over again, it made the wrong notes gradually sound right. The more I did it, the righter the wrong notes started to sound until they didn't sound wrong at all anymore. "Why?" he asked me. "Why didn't those notes sound wrong anymore?" "Maybe it's because the wrong notes are leading somewhere. Repeating the wrong notes allows the listener to know where it's going so that it begins to sound right." I confused myself. It surprised me that Michael understood what I had just said.
That's one of the lessons in the new book, The Music Lesson, A Spiritual Search for Growth Through Music by Victor Wooten. Through narrative and Socratic dialogue, the book provides insights into what music is and how to make it. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
Is everybody musical? What does it take to make music? What can a virtuoso learn from a novice? And when it comes to the electric bass in particular, what are the components of style that distinguish one player from another? Our guest is Vic Wooten, Bass Player Magazine's Bass Player of the Year for 3 years in a row and the only person to win the honor more than once. In addition to playing the electric bass, the double bass, and the cello, he's also a singer-songwriter and the organizer of bass clinics that combine music education with a wilderness experience. His book, The Music Lesson, was published in 2008 by Berkeley Books.
And welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here.
What brought you into what you're doing now, the bass in particular and music in general?
Well, I'm the youngest of five brothers, and they were all playing. So I have four older brothers, and I think either when I was born or before, they decided that if we had a bass player in our family, we'd have a complete band. So when I came around, that became me.
So you had no choice.
Yeah, I mean, I probably had a choice, but, you know, I like to look at music like a language. And if our family speaks English, that's the language we speak. So we could say we have no choice. So music, I was learning the same way. So I guess I didn't have much of a choice.
So did you put the band together and you performed as a
family
band?
Yeah, five of us played. That's how I grew up. By the time I was five, we were out doing gigs. I pretty much grew up in nightclubs on the weekends. at that time, you know, we could make it happen. You know, and you can make anything happen, you know. Our parents were always there. And the clubs would sometimes have to bend the rules. And, you know, and sometimes when we would take a break, we'd either have to sit on stage if there were no dressing room or go out and sit in the car, you know. And I can remember showing up at some clubs in North Carolina when I was probably eight. And the people would have heard of the Wooten Brothers Band. And we'd show up and they'd say, "Wait a minute, these are kids. We can't let these kids in here." So my parents would just calmly say, "Okay, well, you know, we'll go. Then you don't have a band for the night." And they said, "Well, okay, all right. But you have to, you know, stay on stage. You can't leave the stage." And that was just a part of my upbringing.
So how was that for you? I mean, obviously it caught on with you, but, I mean, it sounds like it would have been very hard for a 5, 10, 12-year-old kid.
No, that's not hard for a kid. A kid is adaptable to anything. You know, if a kid grows up on the farm, they do farm work. My parents got up about 4 in the morning and did a few hours of farm work before, you know, getting water from the well, heating it up over the fires, and then getting dressed and walking a few miles so that they could catch a bus to go to school, you know, learning on, you know, old, outdated books.
This is in Virginia.
Well, for them, that was in North Carolina. Now, to me, what my parents came up through was hard. You know, playing music as a kid, you know, that was pretty easy.
You talk about in your book how you had defined yourself as a bass player, but then in this dialogue that happens in the book, you talk about having to learn instead to think of a musician.
Right.
Explain the difference.
Well, I like to say, this may have come from Michael in the book, I'm not sure, but if you're just playing the bass, then you may not be playing music. And what I mean by that, the easiest way to explain it is to think of a language. When you talk, the words that you're saying, you're not thinking of them much. Your focus stays on the overall goal, the message, the feeling that you're trying to get across. And once you can keep your focus there, the words come out on their own. Now, you have to focus on individual words maybe to learn them. But once you learn them, your mind and your feelings broaden back out to the emotional side and the feeling side of what you're trying to say. And all these words that we're using come out on their own. A lot of us musicians are taught to think about each individual note, think about the chords and harmony and things like that, and which is okay. It works. And we're taught to think about music. But I look at music like a language, and I realize that a lot of us musicians are only talking about music when we play. In other words, I'm trying to play the right note, the right chord, the right harmony, or the cool technique. And that, for a listener doesn't want to hear a musician play about music. They want to hear about your life story. And if we think about the musicians that touch us over the years and over decades, musicians that have lasted for decades, you know, we're going to think of maybe like the Beatles, Elvis, you know, James Brown, Ray Charles, Stevie Wonder. These musicians that never go away. We don't look at them as technical players. You're not thinking about the notes they play. You feel their music. And so that's what I'm kind of getting at, is that if you want people to listen to you, you have to approach them on a feeling level, not on the instrument level. In order to get the audience to get past your instrument, you as a musician have to do it also.
I have heard classical musicians say something to the effect of, after a while, you forget the instrument is there.
That's, for me, that's the goal.
And it's directly between you and the listener.
Absolutely. It's like a language. You know, your instrument that you use, you rarely think about when you talk.
Well, to play devil's advocate for a minute, because I used to be an oboist.
Yes.
And taught oboe lessons. Mm-hmm. You have to think about the reed, the keys sticking, the instrument itself sometimes can get in the way of what you're trying to say.
Exactly. You need to know how to do that. But when it's time to play, it's time to play. The same way if I have a toothache, it's going to make it a little harder to talk. There's nothing wrong with thinking about all that stuff. You need to know how to do it. Even with our speaking instrument, which is our voice, our larynx, our tongue, our teeth, the shape of our speaker, which is our mouth, your stomach, everything's involved. You need to know how to take care of that, how to maintain it. If something goes wrong, you focus in, find the problem. But when it's time to communicate, you can't communicate thoroughly and think about any of that. Your mind, to be the best communicator, your mind has to broaden out, and it becomes a feeling, an emotional thing. But like an oboe player, yes, you have to know about reeds. You have to know about all of that. I need to know about strings, how to adjust a truss rod. But when it's time to play, if I'm thinking about that, I'm not going to be as musical.
But what if you're thinking about, okay, you're trying to be musical and a string breaks?
Stay musical.
Stay musical if you're talking and use the other strings.
Yeah. If I'm in front of an audience and I'm talking and I bite my tongue, the audience doesn't have time for me to stop and figure out what's going on with my tongue. Why am I? No. The message has to keep getting across. So if I'm on stage and it's happened many, many times, I break a string, music doesn't stop. If I can only play when my bass is working correctly, then I'm relying on my bass to make music. I'm musical, not the instrument. The music makes it easier. It's like if I'm driving down the street trying to get somewhere and the car breaks down, if I got to be there, I got to find another way. I start walking, you know. So music to me is the same way. Once music starts, it's time to play. And if there's an audience, they don't have time for anything else but for you to get your point across. And if you break a string, you break a reed, you better be a good musician, because then that's going to be the test, is can you still make music, or are you just relying on your instrument?
Well, one of the things you do, speaking of strings, I'm told that during a performance, you will retune your instrument completely.
Sure.
As part of a single song or performance.
Yeah,
I
did that.
How do you pull that off? How do you get the tone right? I mean,
well, that's a good question. I don't quite know. But I just did it one night with the Flecktones, with Bela Fleck and the Flecktones. I get a solo spot every night. And I was kind of tired of hearing myself play, you know. And so I just decided to do something different. And I had noticed that when I'm changing my strings on my bass, before the strings have the complete tension and they're just really flappy sounding, There's some beauty there. That's an amazing sound that we're not used to hearing on a stringed instrument. And so one night, in front of an audience, I just detuned the whole bass and started playing with the strings just totally out of tune and, you know, and just sounds. It sounded like a whale or, you know, marine life. It was just crazy. I just was exploring in front of people. And because I was in front of people, it made me dig down deep and make it work. And after I kind of came out of this trance of, wow, this is cool, I realized, wait a minute, how am I going to end this thing? I can't just stop in front of the audience and start tuning like I normally do. So it hit me that, you know, I just started tuning it while I was still playing it. And then it hit me that, you know what, I bet I could get this thing in tune without the audience knowing that it's in tune. And so I can get the whole bass tuned up and without playing any real notes, just sounds, you don't know it's in tune. And then I stop and restart the same song over again, and the audience is like, how in the world did that happen?
So it seems like magic tricks.
It seems like a magic trick, but like all magic tricks, there's an answer to it.
Well, you have a very simple magic trick, too, that we heard at the beginning of the hour, this concept that the wrong note repeated sounds right after a while.
Yeah, it very well can sound right, but it depends on a bunch of other factors. You know, it's got to be played in time. This has to be the right dynamics. It can't be too loud. You know, the space in between those wrong notes has to be accurate. There's so many other factors that's going to make that true or not. Because usually a wrong note, unless you're playing a unison line where everybody's playing the same line, a wrong note won't sound wrong until these other factors give it away.
Yeah. So there, I mean, there are rules to playing, even in your really broad concept of playing.
Yeah. There are rules, but like talking, if you mess up on a word, who cares? As long as the overall meaning gets across. And the listener, the average listener, is not listening to individual notes. They're listening to the overall feeling. Like a major scale, I don't care what individual notes you play, but a major or a minor scale has a feel to it. And the person, especially the less they know about music, the more they're going to feel what you're playing. And so for me, I'm not as concerned with getting every individual note right. Like I'm not concerned with getting every individual word right. It's the overall meaning that I want to get across.
Well, Beethoven would agree with you. He said exactly that same thing. Don't worry if my nephew misses a note in his lesson, if he's getting the feeling of it.
There you go.
That's what we're
there
after.
There you go. Cool. Beethoven was hip.
You cross a lot of different genres in music. Can you say something about how that works, with whether it's classical or jazz or
sure,
even bringing bluegrass in your book?
Yeah. It's in our, you know, our Western style of music, it's still all the same 12 notes. So it's all made up of the same thing. It's like I can go up north and they'll speak one way. I go south, they speak another way. But it's still the same language. It's just different accents, different interpretations. So I look at musical styles the same way I look at languages. There's many different languages, but we're all saying the same thing. There's many different religions. We're all after the same thing, different types of foods, you know. And so with music, to me, it's the same. But the cool thing about music is a C major chord in classical is the same C major chord that's in jazz or bluegrass or reggae. And so what we have to look at is what's making these styles different. I find out that it's not the notes, because the notes don't change in the styles. It's the other things. And in my opinion, it's these other things that are outlined in the book. It's these other things that are under-taught. We don't pay attention too much. There's not a book out there on how to use rest, how to play space. You know, that's what this book is really about. It's putting some focus on what I believe really takes to be a good musician. Anybody can play the notes right. Right, because there's only 12 of them. How hard can it be?
Yeah, Bach says something like it's just playing the right note at the right time. What else can there be to it?
There you go.
Well, play something for us.
Sure, I'll play something for you. Let's see. What am I going to do? All right, I'm going to play a song. I'll start by playing a song I was kind of hinting at earlier. This is actually a song that's in the book. Instead of calling them chapters in the book, I call them measures. And at the beginning of each measure, there's actually a handwritten measure of music, one measure. So when you read the whole book and put all the measures together, you get a song. And that's the song that's actually on the new CD.
The Lesson.
The Lesson. So I'll play you The Lesson.
What made you decide to call it The Lesson?
For the longest time, I didn't have a title. And that usually happens to a lot of the songs. But I did want the song on the CD I wanted to tie it to the book in some way. And the lesson was the title that stuck.
And what kind of music would you call it?
I wouldn't call it anything unless I was forced to. Mm-hmm. You know, if I had to say, okay, we're going to put it in this bin, I would just try to put it under my name, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it does have a Latin, Spanish, flamenco influence. But I don't know. That's a good one. What would you call it?
I wouldn't either.
Yeah, good.
But
good.
I also was thinking when you were playing about the use of the word play for music. We don't say we're working music.
Right.
And I can see when you're playing, you're playing.
Yeah, yeah. It's fun. And, yeah, I don't want to have to work at it. I don't want to have to concentrate when I'm doing it. I don't want to have to be focused. More so, I want to be unfocused. I want it to happen on its own. And when we do that, we call it being in the zone. You know, but when it's time to practice, we tell our kids and we tell ourselves to concentrate and focus. But in the end, that's not what I want to do. So I should learn how to get better at unfocusing and actually finding that zone that I'm trying to find. You know, and that's why a lot of us can't find it, because, you know, we don't know what it is. We don't work on it. We don't actually practice on it. And it's exactly opposite of what we practice, which is being focused.
Well, is that the same thing as saying, again, that you're learning technique and then you're forgetting it when you play?
Absolutely. The goal is to forget it. You know, in English, you probably know thousands of words, but you don't think of them at all. It's like driving a car. I learn how to change a tire. I want to know how to do it. But then I put the tire and the tools in the trunk and hope I never see them again.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yes,
but it's there,
sure.
Just in case. So the goal is to be prepared, but forget about it. One of the good friends of mine, he actually plays bass. We have two bass players in my band. He's described it the best, and if I could just go through this really quickly. He says it's like there's four rooms, and the first one is what's called unconscious not knowing, meaning you don't know what you don't know, and that's a state of bliss. That's the kid that's playing air guitar, who just plays, and to me that's the proper way to play.
It's no just wrong notes.
Absolutely. No wrong notes, and a smile on her face. But then you take a lesson, and you enter that room of conscious not knowing. Now you know all the things you don't know. That's not a blissful state. The smile's gone, and this is a state where a lot of kids take lessons and they give up. They quit because it's not fun anymore. Again, the smile is gone. But if you persevere that stage, you'll enter into conscious knowing. You'll know some things that you know, and that's kind of fun. You know, you're knowing your scales, or you can play a few songs. You can go out and do some gigs. And the way Anthony describes it is this is the place that probably most musicians remain. They remain in this state. But it's not a blissful state. You know, the smile comes and goes. But then some of people will persevere, and they'll enter the unconscious knowing. So they know what they know unconsciously. Now the smile is back. That's a blissful state again. And these are our master musicians, our Chick Coreas, our Yo-Yo Ma, you know, different people like that. And that's the state that I try to exist in when it's time to play. But the cool thing, Anthony points out, if this is like four rooms in a house, the thing that he notices is that there's no walls in between rooms. So you could walk into any room at any time, but something steps, you know, keeps you back. You might put a foot in there, and then you pull back. And you can see Yo-Yo Ma. You can see Chick Corea in that room, but for some reason you won't go there. And the thing is, once you enter that first room of unconscious not knowing, the only way to get back to that blissful state is to go to that final room, which is unconscious knowing, where you know everything unconsciously. But you can go there at any time. If all you know is a scale, you can know that scale unconsciously, and you can make music with it. And then all of a sudden, you can smile again, you know. And so it's a neat way of looking at it, the way that Anthony put that. And it's brought that attention of, you know, well, what room am I in when I'm playing?
Yeah, somebody once asked a great pianist, so when you're performing, what are you thinking about? And he said, well, I don't know.
Exactly. Exactly. That person is playing, I would say, I would say he's playing correctly. You know, I guarantee it's not the notes he's playing, the same way you're not thinking about the words when you talk. You know, you'd have to figure out, well, what am I thinking about? You know, and then when you try to describe it, it would be considered, people would call it spiritual, you know, which is why people say I'm a spiritual person. To me, I'm just looking at it how I see it. But anything described thoroughly will become spiritual.
More music lessons with Victor Wooten when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Vic Wooten, who is an electric bass player and also the author of the new book, The Music Lesson, published this year by Berkeley Books. It's one thing to be spiritual and to enter into this fourth room of spirituality when you're playing the bass or any instrument, but what about this thing called practice?
Yeah. Practice is necessary, but I think if we make practicing our main focus, it'll take us a long time to learn what it is we want to learn. And this is what goes against formal teaching. We're told to practice as much as possible. To me, music is a reflection of life. And if you're in a room practicing all the time, you're not living. So you have nothing to say when you come out of the room. You're going to be talking about what you've practiced on. You don't learn a language by locking yourself in a room. You got to get out and live. You got to get around other people speaking the language. Hopefully, some people are speaking it better than you, and you'll grow quickly. So I always like to say, show me someone who practices 8 hours a day, and I'll show you a person hard to get along with. And that's usually the case.
True. Yeah.
Usually
is.
Some of our greatest musicians were horrible at life. Success musically, horrible life-wise. I don't want to fall into that category because life is more important than me playing, you know, a piece of wood with four strings on it. I can be musical without this instrument. But sometimes just sitting around playing the instrument can rob me of my musicality. And you think about locking yourself in a room. You come out after, you know, 8 hours or years of doing that, you're not as good of a communicator as you could be.
So if you were to pick up another instrument, are you one of those people who walks into a room and if there's a theremin there or there's a banjo or there's a tambourine or something, mm-hmm. you go to it and start making music?
No, not usually. I can do that, but I don't usually. Maybe when I was younger. I don't feel the need to do that anymore. I am one of those kind of people that can pick up whatever the instrument is and play it. It may take me a minute and play it. And the reason I can do it is because my goal is to make music on it. I just have to learn where the notes are on that instrument. That's pretty easy. That can happen quickly. But knowing that I'm already musical. I'm not starting over on this instrument. I'm just going to express my music through that instrument. And it may come out different. It may not be proper for that instrument, but it'll be music. And my brother, when I was 15, called me and said, hey, I got you a job playing bluegrass fiddle at Busch Gardens, Williamsburg, Virginia. Think you can do it? I said, sure. Never played before in my life. But I had played cello in the orchestra, so I knew what a violinist looked like. I knew what the sound of, and I had vaguely heard bluegrass music.
Did you like it?
Took me a minute. Took me a minute. I really got into it when I heard people stretching it, and I realized, because I only stayed on the outskirts of that style of music, but when I started hearing people like Bela Fleck, and Mark O'Connor, Sam Bush, Jerry Douglas, I realized, wow, this is closely related to jazz.
Well, they're such Bela Fleck and Mark O'Connor are both so well known for crossing from one genre to another.
Right. So once I saw that music crossing that bridge, I was able to cross it and see the original Bill Monroe style of bluegrass and understand what it really was. But when I'm looking at original bluegrass from across the bridge, I wasn't getting it, you know. I didn't talk bad about it, and I appreciate it. But, you know, it's like some of the pop music. I used to hate Madonna. I just didn't get Madonna until I had to learn that music to make people dance. And in learning the bass lines and I was playing that music from the inside out, I was like, ah, now I get it, you know. That's also why I say music can show you a lot about life. You know, we look at people that same way, and once we get to know them, we realize there's more to it.
You know? I see a lot of comparisons that you make in your book between music and nature.
Yeah.
You bring in the hawk, the frogs, all kinds of things.
I started in 1991. I think it was somewhere early 91. I read a book called The Tracker by a guy named Tom Brown Jr. And I got about 3 or 4 chapters in, and I was hooked. And I'm the kind of person that if I read something or see something and I want to learn it, I'm going to find that guy. So I got into this book, and I said, I got to find Tom.
He's got a spiritual approach to tracking.
Yeah, and to nature. And again, you know, we call it spiritual because when you get into anything deeply, I mean, mathematics, if you go far enough, it's going to become spiritual to the outside person who doesn't quite get it. To you, it's just what it is, you know, music, nature, or whatever. So I found Tom and started taking classes with him for a bunch of years. And from my first class, I realized that to me, he was talking about music. He called it awareness, nature, tracking, but to me, it was music. So I was able to take my model of music, because I knew music very well, and overlay it onto what he was talking about, and it sped things up. It wasn't like I was starting from the beginning of his knowledge, and I was able to learn it pretty quickly. And in taking a lot of his exercises, I applied it to music and started trying certain things, blindfolded exercises, looking at the ground, listening to the birds, asking the question, how did a robin learn a robin song? You know, what music school did they go to? And the robin in California sings the same song as the one in New York. How did that happen? How does a beaver know how to chew down a tree and make a dam? Who taught them, you know? So I started looking at that thing. And yes, that becomes spiritual pretty quickly because we don't understand it, you know? And so in tapping into that, I found out a lot about myself and music. But what one of the main things I realized is that it doesn't matter what we're trying to do, whether it's music or interviewing or anything else. We are trying to do it naturally. We are trying to be natural. And to the point that if you do something very, very well, they say you're a natural. Well, dictionary says that the word natural is a derivative of the word nature. It says to be like nature. So in our quest to become natural, we're really trying to be like nature, whether we know it or not. You look outside and we don't have to do anything. Nature thrives. It just does what it does. No one tells the tree to grow. No one tells the birds to sing. No one tells the snow to fall. It just does that. And that's the way we want to do whatever it is we're doing, whether we realize it or not. So I started asking myself, why do musicians lock ourselves in a room? You know, we give it a name. The room is called the woodshed in jazz. So you got to spend hours in the woodshed, you know. We lock ourselves and close ourselves off away from nature in order to be like nature. That's a slow process. We learn to speak English because we get out in nature. And nature meaning life, the movement of life, you know, the relationships between people. That's how we learn quickly. That's why a kid can speak it too. They can improvise. But I know musicians who've been playing for 20, 30 years and can't improvise. They can't say what they want to say. They can only say what someone tells them to say.
That sounds like a cue to me. How about something improvised?
Improvised, sure. Mm-hmm. All right, totally off the cuff. A lot of times when I do this on stage and I'll just try not to know what's coming out. Because that's fun. It's like getting in the car and not knowing where you're going and walking through the woods.
Scary for some, fun for others.
Scary for some, fun, yeah. But I'll just hit a note, you know, and see what happens. And so, like talking, I'm improvising. We're improvising it almost every time we talk, but we're improvising over or with tools that we are familiar with. So I'm probably not playing anything that I haven't played before.
Some progressions that you build something else on or hook
right.
them together.
But I can guarantee it's never come out this way.
Coming out soon on the University of the Air label, available in finer public radio stores.
Well, and that actually brings up the idea of business, which seems so contrary to the fun of it, the improvisation of it, the nature of it. Mm-hmm. But there is a business to music.
It is the music business. That's
and
right.
And how do you keep that from sort of destroying?
Well, the easiest answer to that is that I surround myself with good people. Fortunately, I found a woman, a lady named Danette, who is my business manager. She manages all my musical things and more. And I trust her, and so I can relax and stay focused on the music. But we talk, you know, I probably talk to Danette every day more than I talk to my wife. You know, and my wife is handling the home side. She's taking care of the house, the four kids, homeschooling the kids, paying the bills. I send the checks home, you know. She's taking care of all of that side. Danette's taking care of the managerial side. On the tour, I have a guy named Dave Welch who's taking care of the tour managing. I got a band. Anthony, who I mentioned earlier, is taking care of all my bases. He tunes them, you know, and it allows me to stay more focused on music.
And I notice you give your wife credit for catering on the latest CD, too, so I guess she does wear
Yeah, I record mostly at home, and whenever I bring musicians in, because I live out in the woods, it's not easy to get anywhere, so my wife will just make these, you know, gorgeous meals, and so I had to thank her for that.
Now, the 10 principles that you and the voice, Michael discuss in your book begin with the groove. Now, what's the difference between the groove and the zone?
The zone is a destination, I guess, a place you're trying to get. Very, very related to the groove, but I can play a good musical groove without being in the zone. But if I'm in the zone, the groove will happen by itself.
So by groove, you mean just sort of being in keeping with the music? You and the music are together somehow?
Well, that's taken it a little further, but yes. But for the to start with, a groove of a song, it can be a reggae groove. It can be a swing jazz groove. I can play a classical groove.
Play us some grooves.
Some grooves. Okay. So let's say if I wanted to play something like, let's say. Wrong note. Who cares, right?
Then, call it a grace note.
You can feel the beat. You know where the tempo is. Right? But you wouldn't start breakdancing to that because that's not the right groove for breakdancing. You know? It's not a reggae groove. Now, if I played, let's see. You know, you'd start saying, yeah, man, or whatever.
You start moving with that a little.
Those are two different grooves. You know, I could play like a James Brown type of groove, a slow ballad type of groove. So that's in music, that's the kind of definition of what a groove is. And grooves can be better or worse. You know, I could play that. Still a reggae groove, but it's not. Doesn't feel as good until I smooth it out. So when I'm first talking about getting in the groove, it's just on a musical sense. But then we can go further, like what you were talking about. And then we can actually even take it into life, because a good groove can be like your overall purpose. You know, because what Michael explains in the book is that, especially for a bass player, getting the groove correctly is more important than playing the right note. Because once the groove is there, if you happen to hit a wrong note, if the groove isn't lost, no one will care. The same way when we're talking and things are running smoothly, we're in a groove, I say the wrong word, no big deal. But if I lose the groove when I say the wrong story,
lost his groove.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And you talk about also finding a groove when you're playing with other people, feeling what's happening in a group of musicians
right.
fitting in.
You have to find where their groove is, and that's the same as any relationship, you know. And a lot of times we just call it, in relationships, we call it being compatible, where our groove matches someone else's groove, and then we can groove together. So musically, you have to find their groove. And now I'll take that further and say if there's someone else in the room, meaning there's an audience member or many members, they, to me, become a part of the band. And I have to even find out what the audience's groove is. Now, there's a lot of us musicians, and I hope I don't rub anybody wrong when I say this, but a lot of times when we play jazz music, sometimes we play over our audience's heads.
Oh, I'm sure that's true.
You know, and I can't say that it's wrong, But it depends on what your purpose is, because sometimes you want to do that in a way that pulls your audience forward and helps them,
sure,
you know, evolve.
We have that problem with public radio all the time.
Yeah,
how
exactly.
far do you go?
But there's a gentle balance. But the main thing is it pays to be in tune with your audience. And so as I'm playing, I have to be aware of you all here, all, you know, I have to be aware of everything that's going on, including music.
That's the 10th component of your lesson.
Listening.
Is the listening.
I was struck, too, the way you talked about how dynamics could be used to draw in an audience by actually taking it down.
Absolutely.
Becoming softer.
Absolutely. I was playing the other night, and I was doing just a solo piece. No one else was on stage, and the audience was kind of noisy. At least one section. And I saw Dave Welch, our tour manager, standing on the side of the stage. So I walked over to Dave and I said, Dave, watch. I'm gonna shut him up. And I did it through dynamics. And I can't remember what I was playing. I was playing a groove. It's not only dynamics. When I say dynamics, I don't only mean loud and soft, but something in the music has to change. Because a lot of the times we're so used to hearing music through iPods, elevators, restaurants, that music becomes background noise.
Oh, for sure.
Right? Especially if it stays the same, no matter how good it is. So if you change it on a bunch of different levels, the audience will take notice, no matter what they're doing. So I think I was starting to play the lesson, and I was... Right? So this is the groove. Right? The tempo is... whatever it is. And the audience was just talking. I said, Dave, watch this, right? I just changed everything about it. And I was able to go back. And everyone stopped, you know, when I created that space. Because all of a sudden, what they... thought was talking soft became talking loud, you know. Mm-hmm. And I like to explain that, like, there's always some noise going on. There's usually something, like I can hear the speaker going on, you know, whatever. It could be a fan or whatever. If all that noise were to stop, or even if a piece of it were to stop, you would look in the direction of that silence. The same way you might look in the direction of noise, you will definitely look in the direction of silence.
Very effective part of music.
Absolutely. But there's not a book on it. Teachers don't teach it.
Yeah, it's a tough right? thing to teach, I would guess.
I don't think so. I don't think anything is tough. We teach by example. We think we're really teachers, but as Michael states, and I believe him, we're just showers. If I show it to you enough, you understand it. You know, show you a musician who's great at using space and dynamics, show you one that's not, and let you decide. You know, that's how we show. If I wanted to teach you a major scale, I'd play it for you. I'd show you where to put your fingers. You'd have to figure it out. And if you don't get it, then I show you again. And I show you again until you teach it to yourself. So if you become the teacher and I'm the shower, then I can show you anything, whether it's space or anything. So I think it can be taught. I think it's only tough is because no one's done it, and we have to make up exercises. We got to figure out how to do it. So that's why it's tough. But once it becomes a little bit more mainstream and comfortable to the teacher, it's pretty easy.
We'll be shown some more in just a moment on University of the Year.
We want to know what you think. Get in touch with us at WPR.org and click on Listener Feedback. Your comments are important to us. That's WPR.org.
Yo, Victor!
Yeah, JD.
If you don't do nothing else, groove.
That's from the CD What Did He Say? With our guest, Victor Wooden, a bass player who's won numerous Grammy Awards and has written a book, The Music Lesson, A Spiritual Search for Growth Through Music. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and we're talking about playing the bass, but more importantly, playing music.
Yeah, yeah. There is a slight difference.
Yes. You personify music as a woman at the end of your book. Why is that?
Well, I guess... If I had to quantify it as either, it would be female. When I listen to music, it just comes across that way to me. And music is forgiving, accepting. And if you're not respecting music, music will take a step back and wait for you to get it right. It won't just beat you up. To me, it just has the female compassion.
And yeah. What about that question asked on the CD?
JD, if you don't do nothing else, groove. That's something JD always has. JD's a drummer, incredible drummer. And he would always have that written or something similar written on his snare drum. And JD comes from the like drum and bugle corps with lots of flashy stuff. But you wouldn't know it because his main focus is making the music groove, supporting the music and supporting the musicians he's working with. And so you rarely see his flashy side. And to me, that's the sign of a musical genius and definitely musical maturity. And as a bass player, I ask students all the time, you know, as a bass player, are you a groove player or a note player? You know, and they all say, well, groove. You know, and I say, well, why are you practicing notes all the time? Practice grooving. You know, practice notes a little, but do what people want you to do. You rarely, as a bass player, get a compliment. Man, you played great notes tonight. You know, or your technique's incredible. It's no, man, you got a good groove. If you have a good groove, especially on the bass, you'll never stop working. And so that's what JD was talking about.
Play something for us that highlights that double thumbing technique that
double
you're so well known for.
Sure. This is a piece of a song called Classical Thump that started out as an exercise for me. I don't like practicing, so I like playing. So whatever I'm practicing on, I turn it into music right away so that I can play it. It's like learning a new word from your English teacher. She makes you put it into context right away. You use it in a sentence. She doesn't sit you down and say, now, you say that word over for the next hour, I'll be back. So that's what I do. So I was learning some techniques, and I made up a song that wound up being on my first record. And I'll play a little bit of that. So you'll hear some of the fast things. And here in the studio, you'll see my thumb going back and forth.
Impressive.
Yes.
It's neat because visually nothing looks different. My hand's not moving any faster than down, 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 you know.
Yes.
But when I use my thumb like a guitarist uses a pick, going down and up, I can double the speed and double the output without having to double the input.
What about attacks?
What about attacks? What do you mean?
Well, in terms of different things you can do with those, I mean,
right.
Longer, shorter?
Absolutely, yeah. In the book, we call it articulation. Or duration, holding the notes longer. That's very, very important. And again, it's, I would say, undertaught. Again, it's not in the instructional DVDs and videos, but all important. If I were to play an old song, now that's the bass line to a song called Sitting on the Dock of the Bay.
Otis Redding.
Now that song, exactly. That song played with the right duration and attack. It's this. It's if every note were long, that's one feel. But this first, the second note, the first note has to be cut off at the right time. Right? And then I could go heavily into this, those two notes of that bass line that makes you sit back, you know? And it's not just the notes. No, it's the tempo. It's got to be in the right tempo, right? This note has to have a grace note before, right? But this first note can't run into that grace note. It has to cut off, right? So there's so many nuances, and again, that they're never taught. No one would teach you all that if they were teaching you the bass line. They would just tell you to listen to it, which is cool because you'd figure it out. But these nuances can be taught, I believe. And we could become good musicians almost overnight if we pay attention to the proper things.
You talk about tone and phrasing, too.
Absolutely.
How do they come in?
Well, tone, I like to explain it this way because everybody gets it. If you go into a nightclub, I usually ask people, what is it that makes you want to dance in a nightclub, in a discotheque? And people usually say, well, it's, you know, it's alcohol or it's women or it's the or maybe it's the groove of the song. And all of that is true. All of that adds to it. But really, it's the tone. They always have big speakers. They use subwoofers. And it makes the room, the air, the walls and the floor and the inside of your body shake to the beat.
Yeah, your bones are actually
vibrating. Your bones are vibrating. So without wanting to dance, you're dancing from the inside out. And after a while, you give into it. But the proof here is that if those subwoofers blow out and they only have the high tweeters, okay, the same girls are there. You're just as, you know, inebriated or not, right? Your favorite song is still playing, but the dancing tone has been removed, and so the dance floor will clear. And that's just the truth, you know? So as a bass player, if I want to make you dance, I'm going to add more low end to my bass line.
That's the secret.
And I'm not getting a lot out of this bass, but I'm going to put it down here, right? If I want you to sing along with me, I'm going to put my bass, I'm going to thin it out. I'm going to put it in the, more of a range of where the voice is, right? Because most people aren't going to be singing, sitting on the dock of the bay, you know? So I'm not going to put the melody down there. I'm going to bring it up, which is where your voice is.
Sure.
And if the melody is simple enough that you can pick up quickly, you'll sing along.
Wow, I wish we had another hour. I really do.
Another time.
Yeah, another time, part two. Vic Wooten has been our guest this hour, and it's been a great pleasure.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year. Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, an unusual look at obesity. Obesity as seen in the works of Shakespeare and other great writers of his time. Join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 for University of the Air here on Wisconsin Public Radio.